This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Let's move on to another story, another trial that is about to begin. The Brendan Banfield murder trial. It is beginning this week, and before a single witness takes the stand. This case already has some serious problems, I guess, depending on how you're looking at it. The prosecution's own digital forensic expert concluded their catfishing theory doesn't hold up. He was then transferred out of the unit. The lead homicide detective who pushed back on the command staff's theory was reassigned too. And the original lead prosecutor was removed after being cited for drinking at 8 a.m. So what happens when an investigation starts with a conclusion and works backwards to find the facts? Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, is here to help us kind of break this down. Let's start with Officer Brendan Miller, who analyzed 60 devices and concluded that Christine Banfield, not her husband, appeared to control the FetLife account. His findings were also peer-reviewed by the University of Alabama and confirmed. And then they said, you're never going to do this again. We don't like your findings. They don't necessarily go along with our with the story that we believe happened. Jen, from your experience, how significant is it when your forensic expert contradicts the theory and now he's, you know, no longer in that position?
It's significant. Look, Tony, my favorite evidence always is digital evidence and evidence that doesn't have an opinion and doesn't have a heartbeat. I want to see where the actual facts lead that aren't opinions, they're actual facts. And I can tell you, because back in the day, we got to actually talk to jurors afterwards. Any juror who wanted to stay behind, we could talk to them and discuss, and they will tell you the same thing. In my experience, they love that. It's well above witnesses. So when you have somebody with this, his type of credentials and with the amount of evidence he reviewed, I just got to go with the facts.
Yeah. And this is an interesting case because on the surface, it looks like, oh, well, they check all the boxes here where it must be this. But when you dig deeper, it's like, whoa, wait a second here. I mean, this is why crossing the T's and dotting the I's is important. But here it looks like they did cross the T's and dot the I's. Mm-hmm. It's just that the prosecution didn't like the letters they were using. It's like, we'd like a different font, please. This one doesn't quite match up to the font that we're using over here. And it's like, well, sorry, that's the font that came with this package. According to the court testimony, Deputy Chief Brush told Miller that he would never work another digital forensic case for the Bureau. Miller was in transfer. The lead detective was reassigned. What does it tell you when investigators who push back on the theory get moved off the case?
That's not good.
Well, it is quite unusual, because I will say most of the time when you're putting together these cases, this isn't something that it goes from, you know, ingredients to a cake. There's a long, long way. There's months. There's so many people with, you know, putting their evidence in. So it's very unusual to see something like this, I'll say, first of all. But woo, he's my first witness on the stand if I'm the defense attorney.
Yeah.
What would the purpose be to have this narrative that you want presented? I mean, a case is a case. What difference does it make how it presents itself? I'm just confused as to why they would even have a problem with this.
Well, I am going to say I recently went to some training, and the person presenting, long time, you know, FBI agent forever. He was John Douglas, and he worked together, profiler for many, many years. Greg McCrary is his name. Very famous, famous guy. And he did a great presentation about exactly sort of what you said, having a conclusion in your mind and working backwards to get it to match. And he presented this amazing case, and it was really important to understand how they got to the wrong conclusion. Ultimately, the guy was exonerated, convicted, and then exonerated. And I mean, you even had in that particular case, a guy in the lab lie about finding the guy's fingerprint. it was all false. So wow. These things can happen. And I really liked this particular training that I went to because it's very important as an expert witness. You need to stay up on everything that can possibly happen in a case. And I really think it's important to evaluate all the evidence. And when you have a situation like we're discussing here, you have to take a tactical pause and look at how this could happen. So it's concerning.
Well, Jennifer, they say that doctors do the same thing, that when they walk into a room or they are presented with data from the lab, they get focused on here's what we think it is, but it could be something else. And they are so laser focused. No, it must be this, that maybe they miss a piece. And so you just brought that into my head that, you know what, maybe they got laser focused on this and now it didn't fit the narrative.
It can. I mean, that's certainly what can happen, but mm-hmm. I'm telling you, it is not the rule. It is the exception. I mean, you know, most FBI agents and investigators want to get to the truth. They want the right person behind bars, but some people do get tunnel vision. It happens. And you get so tunnel vision that you just can't see the forest for the trees.
Yeah. There was a comment that was just made here where it said, just because a digital forensic expert, I want to correct you there. There's multiple people. It's not just a digital forensic expert that's saying this is not, you have multiple people on this case who were moved off when their conclusions did not go along with the said original theory of the case by the prosecution. So it's not just a one-off here, because it just seems like that was kind of minimizing it or not understanding the full gravity of this. Fairfax had 12 homicide detectives working the case. Prosecutor Eric Klingon even said there were 24 different theories until Juliana, and we're going to get into her in a moment, this is the affair, gave her proffer. This is where she gave her statement, basically stating, we did it. And if I tell you that we did it, I get to go back home, right? And I don't get charged. They're kind of the little agreement that they made there. From an investigative standpoint, is it normal for a case to have that many competing theories almost 2 years in? And then we also have to start considering here, well, you got an agreement with your star witness who is allegedly part of this, but she gets to go off scot-free as long as she continues to hold that torch and go down the line with the theory that you want presented. Seems a little questionable, but how common is this?
It's really not common. It's very rare. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. We've seen it happen before, but it's really rare for people to provide confessions, especially if they're detailed. Believe me, there's some out there. I could give you an example right now of somebody I'm thinking of, which is Dassey, who was a 16-year-old and confessed, and it's the worst confession I've ever seen on film, and it was so wrong. Yeah. But not to digress, sticking to this, it is really, truly rare. But what you have to do when you take in a confession is you have to really go through, in other words, the proffer here, and you have to look at every single minute detail and say, does that line up with the independent evidence so that we can corroborate what she says? And that's the snafu here with the digital analyst.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it took 8 months to arrest the au pair and 19 to charge Brendan Banfield. What does that timeline suggest to you about the strength or the weakness of the evidence in this case?
Well, whenever you look at the length of time that an investigation takes, it's going to take a long time if you are properly doing an investigation. Obviously, when you have a murder, you want to jump on that quickly because you have a murderer out there and you don't want to have somebody capable of murder free to possibly murder again while you're investigating. But it's critical that you do the investigation correct. Look at the David investigation. I mean, that is really dragging out. There's a lot of these that are dragging out, but I think all will agree it's so much better to do it right and get it right the first time than to speed it up and have it be wrong.
Well, and they probably were pretty certain that they didn't have like a threat to the community. This was an isolated event in this one house. they weren't concerned that the community was at risk at any point with this. So they probably could take their time.
So Stacy, I will say this, and I say this with every case. I said it on Brian Koberger, most recently with the Tepe case, the dentist and his wife that were murdered. Mm-hmm. When you have somebody capable of committing that murder, yeah, they're not your target now. But what happens when somebody starts looking at them or something happens and they are worried about being outed or, you know, that's when they turn their attention at you. So people who are capable of these sorts of murders, they are always a dangerous to the community. End of story, because at any time somebody can become their target.
Thank you for that clarification.
There's the frame photo of Brendan and Juliana on the nightstand. It's kind of becoming a popular piece of evidence here that we know about. It was found 8 months after the murders. People are going, see, they were having an affair. We already know they were having an affair. That wasn't like really in question. We knew he was cheating on his wife with the au pair. Wife is now dead. They're together. It seems they're like kind of raising the kids together. They found love or whatever. It's an icky piece of evidence. It's one that if they did this, you know, it looks kind of shitty. But, you know, if this was some horrible situation that they truly did walk in on and, you know, wife is dead, they killed the guy that they thought was harming her. You know, it's not insanely ridiculous to, you know, if they were to fall in love and you know, be a couple all those months later. How damaging is the picture on the nightstand? You know, there's a visceral effect, you know, that people have in their guts. But let's talk about this more realistic perspective on reality's terms of, does it mean much?
Well, I people always want to see some verification that's in form of video or photographs, yeah. Right? It's I'm going to digress back to David and Celeste. Mm-hmm. All of those videos and photos, because it's proof. It's proof of a situation, right? And we're all looking for that proof of them in bed together or some naked pics, right? We all want to see if that's ever going to come out to verify what everybody thinks in terms of that affair. But yeah, there's a visceral effect. People love photos and it shows what, you know, was going on, I think. So to some degree, it's important.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.